The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
On the show today, we're going to answer a couple of listener emails. The first one, actually, I don't know what order we're going to go in, but one of the email questions is on withdrawal rates from your retirement accounts. The other one is a question, kind of a follow-up from last week's blog or podcast, excuse me, asking a question about Roth 401ks and whether they should be contributing there or to the regular 401k. Hi, my name's Chris, Chris Stein. I'm here with Jim Saulnier. Jim, do you have your mic on? I don't. You don't?
I do now.
There we go. I thought your breathing was very quiet over there. Usually I can hear a little breathing action through the mic, but yeah, exactly that. So thanks, everybody, for joining us here on the podcast version of the Retirement and IRA Show.
We're a step closer for our iTunians for broadcasting live. Chris gave us, I think it was on Monday, today's Monday, I think it was last Friday. You gave us the two thumbs up on some app or whatever that's going to plug into our website. Is that how it works?
Right. So it looks like the way our destination, I know for a few weeks or a couple months ago, we were talking about broadcasting live on Facebook. We decided to make a little more broadly available instead of
being some of us are not on Facebook.
Yeah. So we're going to have a way to listen directly from our website, and there's also a mobile app that you'll be able to use if you'd prefer to do that. If you have a mobile device,
kidding, really?
Yeah.
Mobile so do app. They have to? They download an app?
Yeah.
Is it a Time and IRA Show app?
No.
Oh.
But you can find us on that app.
So there's an app that they'll download.
It's a streaming app.
It's a streaming app
for this particular service.
And then Retirement and IRA Show will be on that.
Correct. And we'll give you the specifics on how to find.
So we paying for all this? This isn't free, I take it.
No, it's not free, but it's not real expensive.
No, listeners don't pay. We pay.
No, it's no charge for listeners.
Okay.
So coming right out of your pocket, Joe.
My pocket.
Yeah.
And when were we going to tell me that I was paying for this?
Someone else was going to deliver you that deliver you that message.
Okay, well, apparently I'm paying for something, folks, and so they'll have an app. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we'll be listed Retirement and IRA Show.
I'm not sure how it shows up, but it'll be easy to find.
Yeah. Okay, but they can also go to Jim Helps. That's Jim HELPS.com, and I think somewhere on the top, Julia and Code Geeks, the people who program our website, they are going to embed this app. and I think it flashes or says on air now or whatever, and they just click some button and they can just hear it right from there.
Or the retirementandiraShow.com, the other website dedicated specifically to the show, will have the player embedded there, and then somehow there'll be links to go to the app if you choose to do that on your mobile device.
So this is all happening, folks. It's taking place. And do we know for sure, so our listeners can start blocking off their time, is it? Are we still going to be recording Mondays around 2-ish?
Through this semester,
And then it'll change.
And then that's kind of, we could probably still do that if Mondays are working. If not, we'll switch
to
Tuesdays.
Doesn't matter to me. Whatever day works for you. You've got a much tighter schedule than I do. I'll freely admit that. So whatever day works for you.
I think Mondays are going to work.
Mondays around 2-ish or 2:30?
Yeah, definitely for the next several months, about 2-ish.
Okay.
I think 2 would be a good time to start the live broadcast, if you will, 2 o'clock Mountain Time.
And then our whole hope, folks, is you listen live as we're recording. You'll also be able to hear it on iTunes that coming Saturday, but on Tuesday as we're recording the show.
Or Monday,
when we're recording the show, you can also listen live. We'll be reading emails and answering them, but the whole point is you can also call. And that's the key. You're going to be able to call our office, and either Andrew, Justin, if he's not in the recording studio with us, or more likely than not, Laura, our lovely new administrative assistant. She's wonderful. I don't know if you had a chance to talk to her. She's very smart, learning very quickly. I'm very, very impressed by her. But one of them will answer the phone, get a little idea of the topic you want to talk about. We have to figure out a way that they could send it in to us. Remember at the radio station, there's some sort of whiteboard, and they type to us, and we can see it. We have to get a way of how she can type. You know, on the phone now is so-and-so from, you know.
Could text messages.
You could text us, but if there's a way to inter-office memo each other. There's got to be a program out there that does that.
Yep.
But then we'll bring you on the show. You can ask your question, and we can hopefully answer it while recording. And if you stump us and we can't answer it, we'll we'll get back to you. Say, hey, we can't answer this. But especially if you need, like if it's a Pete question or a Brandon question or a Jan Lord question, and we need to bring in one of these other professionals to address their specific question, we'll get to it on another show. But that's probably what's going to make it most interesting for our iTunian listeners. The other thing is the name of the show is going to change. What? I originally thought it was going to be Retirement and IRA Show Live. But after talking with Julia, a marketing person, she likes Retirement and IRA Show Q&A.
That's still kind of long, just so you know, for putting that on the title of something.
No, it's going to be the same logo on iTunes, Retirement and IRA Show, but the graphic designer is going to put a red Q and a red A. Q stands for question, A stands for answer.
Yeah, I think we got that part, but that's really super long.
Q&A?
No, the Retirement and IRA Show. It starts out humongously long, and then
Have you seen our logo? It just says Retirement and IRA Show is a cute little logo, and the Owen Show is a radio microphone. So it's going to be Retirement and IRA Show Q&A to differentiate itself from Retirement and IRA Show Colorado Edition, which is the new version of the radio show. The live radio show, not live, but the Colorado dedicated radio show. Okay, so on today's show, folks, our iTunians, we have two questions. One involving a state Chris has never received an email from, so he was giddily excited when I told him we had another star. And another email from a gentle person. I'm not quite sure what state they're in, but that email, we'll get to that one first. We actually answered last week. Not this person's, but we had the exact same question.
Oh, it's a popular question, so I'm glad we answered it last week.
I think he'll be able to divine his answer and things he has to look for by listening to last week's show, and that's what I'm going to get to when we answer his question. Okay, so shall we get to that one first?
Yeah, let's knock that one out, and then we'll tell people how they can listen to that answer.
Perfect. Okay. That's the wrong one. Is that the right one?
Oh, my goodness. You're so organized. You have two whole pieces of paper there to try to figure out.
Then I stand corrected. The one that we've already answered is from someone in a state we don't have. So you're going to have to get your stars again and your hallelujahs.
Okay, I've got my stars ready.
Okay.
From which state is this question?
Kansas.
Hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
That is exciting because for those of you who don't know, we have a map of the United States where a star is placed upon each state as we receive our first question from that state. We've got well over half the states covered at this point, but for some reason until recently, we had no states that bordered Colorado with stars, but we've now got a flurry of activity. We've got a Wyoming star, a Utah star, and now a Kansas star. So I'm going to place this fabulous blue star right on Kansas. And now we just have to beg for Nebraska and New Mexico. I've given up on New Hampshire. Clearly, no one is going to contact us from New Hampshire.
What about Maine?
Well, they're busy with the moose and everything. They got the moose. They got the lobster. I can kind of understand. But what are they doing in New Hampshire?
Commuting to Boston and working there.
Well, they're really busy then, apparently. They don't have time to ride
traffic
in.
Traffic stinks driving into Boston from New Hampshire.
Oh, for sure. Well, everywhere, every traffic around Boston is a nightmare. Do they have that... The Big Dig or...
Oh, the Big
tunnel?
Dig's done. Did that help? A long time ago.
Did that help?
It helps a little bit. That's crazy. Still a hell of a lot of traffic.
I will say one of the most amazing machines I've ever seen in my life is that machine that moves the zipper line. Yeah, the zipper line where they move the center cement barriers.
The Jersey barriers.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's common on the East Coast, period, not just in Massachusetts.
That's the only place I've seen it.
Really?
The first time I saw that, we're driving around, there's this big machine, and in the front of it goes those big pieces of concrete, and out the other side, out the back end of it, it comes out. No, it was moving them
moving them to the other lane. When it moves it the other way, it zips it.
It's crazy.
So, yeah, zipper lanes, we call them. So you can commute into Boston in the morning and out of Boston in the afternoon extra lane.
So if you're in New Hampshire, I guess you don't have time to listen to the show or write in. I'm sorry for that. In Maine, we'll just...
So we're looking for the northern New England states of New Hampshire and Maine. We do have Vermont. Yeah. I don't remember getting an email there, but we have a star on Vermont.
We've had Vermont for quite some time, but we're going to... Maine, New Hampshire, and then Nebraska, New Mexico. We've had all this activity locally here, close out here in the West with all these states, so maybe we'll concentrate on Nebraska and New Mexico. That's got a much higher likelihood of happening than Maine and New Hampshire.
We don't have many states left, but no. We do have
and
a
hopefully
question.
We can hear from North Dakota. Just last night, Miss America, North Dakota. First time ever.
Okay.
Those little states, they never get Miss America. Well, North Dakota.
Now they did.
That was amazing.
All right. I have no idea. I don't watch Miss America.
Yeah, I just happen to watch it.
Okay, well, I will say I almost didn't answer this question, mostly because the person I saw at Kansas, and I was thinking of the Kansas City Chiefs who beat my fine New England Patriots on Thursday, but I realized Kansas City of the Kansas City Chiefs is actually in Missouri.
Oh, yeah, so we love people from Kansas.
People from Kansas, but you Missourians, to hell with you. You're not getting any answers from me. Not when your team is beating my
team. You're still a little
team.
Raw about that? That was a long time ago.
Oh, God,
that
was Thursday. It was last Thursday. We played like bums. I'm not used to losing. Now I know what it's like
to be a stinky team.
Jeez, a home game.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. They looked like the Bad News Bears.
Looks a little rusty.
Oh, a little rusty. Their first drive was good, and then they went downhill from there.
Yeah. God. Kansas City's good, though, this year.
Kansas City is a good team.
It's not like you lost to the Browns or something.
No, but give us time. The way we were going, we have no defense, and our offense is predicated on a 40-year-old man who is young, but by football standards, not very young. So it should be an interesting year. Hopefully, we'll pull our act together. Okay, so he begins, "For your radio program, I have a question. I have approximately $500,000 in a 401k. Beyond that, I have very little saved for retirement." God bless you.
Excuse me.
My wife and I are both in our early 50s. So I will say, having $500,000 in a 401k in your early 50s, you are leaps and bounds ahead of the average American.
True.
So he made it sound like, I don't have very much.
No.
That's $500,000. I agree. $500,000 in the grander scheme of things is not a lot of money when people spend that much on a house. But $500,000 compared to what most people have saved for retirement, he's leaps and bounds ahead. "My wife now has the option to open a Roth 401k. My income. What was I going to have you remind me on? Just remind me about Roth 401ks.
Okay.
Roth 401ks. It has to do with last week's answer we gave.
Okay.
Okay. My wife now has the option of a Roth 401k. Our income with bonuses is around $220,000. It doesn't seem like a great idea to put money in a Roth given our current tax rate. But since we don't have any Roth-like savings at the moment, I'm considering it. I'm just wondering what you think.
Mm-hmm.
And this ties in really with last week's question. Almost.
It does. The previous reader, listener, if you will, that wrote into us about this had more substantial assets.
Correct.
So they had... So I guess the short answer is you should listen to the podcast from September 9th, 2017. We have a very lengthy answer on this where we discuss
it right at the beginning. It's right at the beginning.
Right, so the podcast, that has a wealth of information. We spent an hour plus actually on this. So we got really into this. This particular, the listener from last week had more substantial assets. So they had more of a required minimum distribution bomb, if you will, looking them in the face at age 70 and a half that they were having to worry about. So their situation is a little bit different.
A little bit different.
But this gentleman... similar answer,
exactly.
I think, to this.
I think you could listen to that show, listener, because it will give you a lot of food for thought. Slightly different scenario, slightly different circumstances, but good food for thought. For you yourself, I want to first of all, again, give you kudos. To have $500,000 in your early 50s already saved, I can't say you're doing fine if you're like running out buying a new Bentley every other year, but if you maintain a modest lifestyle in retirement, planning on working maybe another 8 to 10 years, I think he may be okay. We won't know until we crunch numbers, but pat yourself on the back because you have more than what most people have.
They have substantial earnings and should be able to put in
absolutely.
Put away quite a lot.
We don't know, but
Kansas.
Hopefully, living in Kansas, yes. Mm-hmm. But Kansas, by the way, has the lowest cost for long-term care of any state.
Well, there's a bonus.
So there's a bonus for living in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you can consider a lot of that. What I want him to, first of all, know is I give him kudos for thinking ahead. Retirement planning, folks, and I say this all the time, think back to when we were growing up. I'm 54 years old. When I grew up, I didn't have all the electronic gizmos that Chris's kids have. So when we wanted to do things, our parents kicked us out of the house and yelled at us to go to the playground. And when we went to the playground, there was a seesaw. And the analogy I give for retirement planning, Chris, is you're having a seesaw ride with the older you. It's the younger you seesawing with the older you. So you're sitting there as the 55-year-old you playing seesaw with the 75, 85, or 95-year-old you. And it's a give and take, folks. Anything you do now to help you might hurt the older you. Anything you do to help the older you go up might hurt the younger you. And the idea is to get things to balance. So he's thinking ahead, Chris, and he's saying to himself, we have all our money in 401ks. And 401ks are always going to be taxable. And he's beginning to recognize, hopefully from listening to us, that he lacks tax diversification.
Right. He's got everything piled up to be taxed in retirement.
Exactly. And at 70 and a half, when required minimum distributions begin, Social Security can no longer be delayed. You turn it on, the latest you turn it on is 70. Now, Social Security is unique. You do not have to turn it on. You can tell them to keep it, and they'll thank you. But they're not going to give you any more money later, so it's foolish. But you could. You could say, hey, don't send it to me. But for 99.99999% of people out there, they're going to turn Social Security on by 70.
Mm-hmm.
So you have your Social Security coming in. If he has a pension or an income annuity, that should be paying out by then. Then required minimum distributions fall on top of it. He's only in his early 50s. Let's just say he's 52. I'm making that up. He didn't give me his age. He still has 20 years to go before RMD is essentially going to kick in. 70 and a half. So he might have 18, 20 years. Years from now. Who knows how big his $500,000 will be?
Mm-hmm.
It could be $1.5 million by then. He's making, as a family, they're making $220,000 a year. What if they're putting 50 of it in a retirement account? There could be over $2 million in an IRA by time he's 70 and a half. So he could have required distributions pushing $150,000, $200,000, $250,000. Plus Social Security and any income annuity and any pension he may have. So he's not going to have much tax diversification in the future, Chris. What you guys need to think of, all you do-it-yourselfers out there, as you're trying to put your retirement plan in place, look at every account your money is in. Because one of three things is going to happen. Money coming out of that account is going to be always taxable, maybe taxable, or never taxable. It's one of those three. And right now he's saying to himself, this gentleman who wrote to us, it's always taxable. He's in the always taxable realm. And he's smart enough in his early 50s to be thinking of where he's going to be in his 70s and 80s, thinking, I'm going to have one hell of a tax nightmare. And he's trying to get tax diversification, trying to get some money in the never taxable realm, which would be a Roth account. A maybe taxable realm would be a brokerage style account. It's not an IRA. It's not a 401k. It's a non-retirement account. In the industry, they call them non-qualified accounts. Those might be taxable. We don't know. You might have offsetting losses, Chris, to offset the gains. If you do pay taxes on it, it's generally at capital gains rates, which under current laws could be as low as zero, depending on what bracket you're in. Mm-hmm. So we call those accounts maybe taxable. And in a well-defined retirement, it's okay to have some money in a 401k, but some of the things he has to look at is what is his tax diversity? What is his tax discretion, rather, not diversity? What is his tax discretion going to be at 70 and a half? Because as we pointed out last week in our answer to the gentleman who had similar concerns, different scenario, you have to look at how much of your income tax brackets are being filled by non-discretionary income, Social Security, pension, annuity, required minimum distributions. All that's going to fill your tax brackets every year, Chris. And it's only money coming out after all that from your retirement accounts, coming out of the always taxable account, that's going to sit on top of that and be taxed at those rates. And I think that's what he's thinking of. We can't tell you, though, listener, without crunching numbers, if it makes more sense to pay taxes today with your income today of $220,000, and when I say pay taxes today, put money in a Roth IRA because it's after-tax money, Chris, does it make more sense to pay taxes today and in retirement you're going to take it out in a lower bracket, or does it make more sense for him to continue putting money into a 401k because in retirement he thinks he's going to be in a lower bracket? He's got two different retirement dates to look at. The date he actually retires and 70 and a half. And the closer both those dates are together, the less planning opportunities you have. But if he's going to try for an early retirement, maybe try to retire at 58. I'm just making that up. And let's say he's going to try to retire a little bit earlier, he could have 12 years before he turns 70 and a half. And we call that your tax planning window. That's your verbiage for it, mm-hmm. Tax planning window. I call it the tax hole. Justin calls it the tax void. Whatever you want to call it, it's a period of time where he might be able to put money in a 401k today and get, he's probably in the 25 to 28% bracket right now, and get a deduction at the 25 or 28, and hopefully in that tax planning window, get money out maybe in the 15, because maybe an analysis will show once his tax discretion is over, 70 and a half is hit, maybe he is going to be back into the 25 or 28. So it creates this kind of hole or window or planning opportunity. We can't, unfortunately, and I think you'd agree, Chris, just answer his question willy-nilly.
No, there's no one answer here. This is definitely a needs to be custom tweaked for your particular plan. So you need to look to the future. You certainly won't be able to tell me in 15 years what tax rates will be. That might be an educated guess that you're making there. But there are other things that will play into this decision, say the year you plan to retire, how many years you've got before you turn on your Social Security, when you're going to turn on your Social Security, what other pension income you might have, when that's going to turn on. All of those things are going to play a part in here. And with a strategy to include all that information, you can pick what should be the best tax opportunity here, because that's really what the question is.
Right.
When do I want to experience these taxes? Because when you experience them will determine a lot as to what rate you're going to pay. And if you're like me, you want to pay the lowest rate possible.
Absolutely. If he has $500,000 saved and they're saving more and he has a pension or an income annuity plus Social Security, he's probably going to be at 70.5 in a very high bracket, maybe even higher than he's in now. And perhaps saving in a Roth right now would make more sense. Okay, before we take a quick break so I can grab a water, I want to tie this in, Chris, to last week. Remember last week we were answering this very same question, just a different scenario?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make one mention because in this particular issue, the gentleman was going to have his mortgage paid off next year.
Mm-hmm.
He was prepaying it, and he was going to have free cash flow of $3,000 a year. And $3,000 a month. And he was wondering what he should do with that, in addition to a similar question. So this was just one aspect of his question.
Mm-hmm.
And you came out with a suggestion, and then Justin, because Justin had suggested to start saving that money, I think he was saying in a non-Roth option. He was going to take advantage of the backdoor Roth because neither mm-hmm. him or his wife had an IRA. So we were recommending he do the backdoor while that's still viable.
Right.
And then you mentioned conversions. The one thing I want to throw out there, two things. First, all their money is in 401ks, 457, and 403bs. He has to find out if his employer or his wife's employer, I think all the money was with his wife, if they allow converting. He doesn't have, and they don't have their money in IRAs. That's why the back door was going to work out perfect for that couple.
Right.
So true. Not all employers allow converting. So the first thing to do, listener, from last week, is to find out if your employer allows Roth conversions. The second thing, you had best be careful and make certain you actually want to convert the amount you want to convert. Because if you do convert and use some of your mortgage savings to pay the taxes now so you don't pay them later, you too, like the earlier caller we just talked about, is trying to create tax diversification. All his money, and there was a lot of money in it, is in always taxable. And he's trying to get it into the never taxable. What can't you do, Chris, with a Roth conversion through a 401k?
You cannot recharacterize. So it's a one-way door. You can go to the conversion. You can't undo it if you later find out you converted more than you're comfortable with or you decide to undo the whole thing. That is a technique that's available when you go from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA via the conversion. You can undo that by October 15th of the year following the year that you do the conversion. But that is not allowed with a conversion from a 401k.
Right. And I didn't think last week to mention those two caveats. I still like your idea.
I threw it out there as kind of a one thing to consider
right.
in there. Certainly if you're barred from doing it because his employer
right. And I just wanted to mention that to him.
Mm-hmm.
But also to let our iTunians know, when you convert at the 401k level, you cannot undo it. So you really have to convert an accurate amount. When you convert an IRA, Chris and I always say, convert it all. We don't care. Because the following year, you do your taxes, you undo it, everything is fine. You don't have that flexibility with a 401k.
Perfect. So we're going to take a quick break so Jim can get a little drink here. And we'll be back with you here in a moment on the Retirement and IRA Show.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. We're going to delve into our second email question now. Thanks for sticking with us through the break here. For those of you planning ahead, at the end of this segment, if you stick around, we're going to play for you the, it's not even an hour, it's probably about 40 minutes of the radio show that we do here in Colorado. So in that, we cover some property titling questions as far as the difference between tenants in common and joint tenancy with right of survivorship. So if you stick around after the end of this podcast, you can listen in on that.
And beneficiary designations.
And beneficiary designations, exactly.
And there's no, we cut out all the bantering, all the commercial time. It's just us talking.
Correct.
So you're welcome to stay on. We're going to do this for a couple more weeks until we're fully broadcasting live. Then we're not going to be doing that anymore. But just as a service to our iTunians, if you want to hear what we were talking about in Colorado, that will be available to you.
Perfect.
Okay, so this next question, when we were off here, I was making a nice coffee, and then Chris asked, how long are we going to talk about this? I think he knew I could probably go on for a long time on this, so I won't. I promise you, because I know you have to get home. And I don't know where this gentleman is from. I think he's a repeat. His email looks familiar to me. So
we probably already have a star for him.
Yeah, I think he's a repeater.
That's okay. I'm satisfied if we get one star per show. I'm not going to be greedy. Since we went months and months and months without any new stars. So I'm excited that the last two, we had two last week and we get one this week. We're on a roll.
You're on a roll. How many
we're going to have to go international and
what
start
What do we
covering.
Have left? Why don't you count the state? I don't think we have okay, more than 10 states left.
Probably not. Why don't you
so
read?
So let me read, I'll read the question. Okay, it begins. Hi, Jim and Chris. Please tell me what is wrong with this idea. When I start withdrawing from my 401k, I am planning to take 3.5% of the balance in 12 installments across the year. So in other words, he's going to take them monthly. So he's taking monthly withdrawals, not one annual withdrawal. If there is a drop in the market, then I will simply recalculate the 3.5% and start taking that amount. This does ignore taking out extra for taxes. What do you think? Thank you. And he went ahead and signed his name, as we always do. He put it in quotation marks, so it's not his real name. He signed it George.
Just what I always wanted, my own little bunny rabbit. I will name him George, and I will hug him and pet him and squeeze him.
I'm not a bunny rabbit.
So we call everyone, even if you put his real name in there, we'd have called him George anyways. We protect his privacy. Before we jump into this, how many states do we have left?
We only need 12.
12?
We've got 13.
Eight
states.
I thought you were going to say 39.
Yeah, 38 states.
Unless Puerto Rico was added.
Yeah,
to
well,
the
they're 50. On the verge, right? Yeah. They voted. I think they want to do that. But yeah, we'll see if it happens. The first thing I'll say to this, he'll never run out of money doing this.
No.
Because
that's a recalculation
method. If he's only going to take 3.5% plus taxes even, I don't care what the tax rate is, if he's only going to take 3.5% plus taxes out of there, he'll never run out of money.
And let's explain what Chris means, because this ties into safe withdrawal rate, SWRs. And that has hit the industry hard, because for years the industry was I don't want to say touting, but in the 1990s, a gentleman named Bill Bengen, and I don't think it's Bengen, it's Bill Bengen or something like that. I always call him Bengen, but I think he pronounces it differently.
I'm not sure.
You know either. Me with names. Yeah. I mean, I have a tendency to mispronounce names. I'll call people the wrong name. But I do know his first name is Bill, and it's Bengen or something like
so
that.
So just say some dude named Bill came up with this idea.
It's pretty much Bill Bengen. Or Bengen, it might be Bengen, whatever. Sorry, Bill, I'm butchering your last name. He came out with it in the early 90s when spreadsheets finally came out. Mm-hmm. And I won't bore everybody with how he came up with the safe withdrawal rate, which was 4%. It was actually 4.3%. And the industry press, it was the press, because his original study was 4.3 as a safe withdrawal rate. The press rounded it to 4. Mm-hmm. And four.
But it's a little different than this because
it is different
because his version of it, the way this worked, is he said at retirement you take out 4%, and his version of retirement I think was at 65. Didn't he pick an age that was typical? I'd have to go back and look at it. I should know it off the top of my head. I admit,
I believe it was,
but it was a typical retirement age. if you take 4% of your portfolio and then withdraw that amount, increasing every year for inflation. So not even that. So just to stay at the purchasing power, so spending power in your retirement of 4% of your original account balance, through some analysis, he found that the likelihood of you running out of money was very low.
Correct.
But not impossible.
Not impossible.
And that was that's one of the
issues. With a balanced portfolio as well.
Correct. He had a special, he had decided a certain mix.
I believe it was a 60-40 or a 50-50
portfolio. I think so too. Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's how Bill came up with it, and spreadsheets allowed him to do this. Now, the thing with Bill's approach, the thing with the withdrawal rate where you set the initial withdrawal rate. So the withdrawal rate, let's just say there's $1 million in the portfolio. And we're going to talk about Bill's strategy before we get to this gentleman's strategy. And let's just say we use 4 instead of 4.3, which was Bill's original number. And let's say there was $1 million in there. So you would start with a $40,000 withdrawal.
Correct.
So that sets kind of your base withdrawal, your floor, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You were never going to take out less than 40.
Correct.
He was saying you could start, it was actually 43 if we used 4.3, but he said you would start with 40. And then every year you would adjust it for whatever that year's inflation is. Now here's where it gets a little tricky. He was using CPI. I would use your own personal rate of inflation, which is going to be different as you age, depending on what a lot of your expenses are. You may have a lot of medical expenses or housing expenses or transportation expenses, which tend to go up far faster than food and, clothing. And
but that would start to blow holes in his plan. So you have to go with his plan. Which
well,
is,
his plan was CPI.
CPI.
So let's just say CPI was 1.8 the following year. Your $40,000 would be increased by $720. And in year two, you're withdrawing $40,720. Mm-hmm. Now, that would continue every single year. Now, in this scenario, you can run out of money, and people did. Because look at it this way. What happens if your portfolio then fell, Chris, to $800,000 from $1 million, and your withdrawals were now $43,500? I'm just making that up. Mm-hmm. So you have $43,500 coming out of an $800,000 portfolio. You originally started withdrawing 4%. You're now up to 5.44, 5.5%. And if your portfolio kept falling, let's say it was a bad correction like we had in 2000 to 2002, and again in 2007, 8, and early 09, you could end up withdrawing 8, 9, 10, 11% of your portfolio. And that can start to get you to fall victim to sequential risk, sequential return risk, we call it, reverse dollar cost averaging, whatever euphemism you want to give it. And your portfolio could be depleted. So the safe withdrawal rate ran into some issues, but for the most part, it can work if you start at that low rate.
It's got a decent probability of happening, but the big question is how, and the reason to kind of we've adapted a different approach here is we were worried about the question, and a lot of clients are, when you ask clients what their number one fear is in retirement, it's running out of money. Well, the fear is, well, what is my situation going to be if I do run out of money?
Exactly.
That's what prompted this whole process that we've come up with here.
Now, let's look at his idea.
Yep.
His is a recalculation method.
Right.
It's more dynamic than Bill's method. Bill's method, again, sets the withdrawal floor on day one. 4%, or technically 4.3. He came out with a new opinion piece. I forget where I read this, where he says it's 4.5. You could actually use 4.5. Again, it originally was 4.3. He's actually raised it a little, I guess because of how well the market has done lately. I don't know. But 0.2% higher now than his original 4.3. But again, the industry press is the one that rounded it down to 4. So whether you start with 4, 4.3, 4.5, it's up to you. But under his, the floor is set. Here's your base withdrawal rate. I'm going to adjust it for inflation, and I'm going to stick to that through hella high water. That's what I'm going to do. This gentleman is a little different. Mm-hmm. And let's use his 3.5 that he begins with. And let's just pretend he has $1 million in there. So he's going to begin with $35,000 plus taxes.
Right.
Now, Bill's safe withdrawal rate, your taxes were coming out of that. Mm-hmm. If you needed more for taxes, you're getting ahead of the safe withdrawal rate. This gentleman is saying, I'm going to start at 3.5, a little lower than Bill's number, but I'm going to add taxes in. So I don't know every year how much he has to take out for taxes, but let's just say it's another $5,000 to make this nice and round. Mm-hmm. So he's up to 40,000, same as Bill's initial withdrawal rate. So now he's at 40. But the following year, the portfolio drops 20%. Or a little bit under 20. He took out 40, portfolio dropped some, and now he's down to 800,000. Under Bill's plan, he still would have been taking his 40 adjusted for inflation.
Correct.
Now, this gentleman doesn't talk about what he's going to do for inflation. He may be saying to himself or to us, because he never mentioned adjusting it for inflation, I think he thinks as the portfolio rises, and he continues taking money out, there's his inflation adjustment. Mm-hmm. But my scenario right now is it fell.
Right.
So now it's 800,000. So in his recalculation method, the following year, he's not going to take out 40,000 or 35 to begin with. He's going to take out 28,000. And maybe
plus taxes, maybe it ends up being 32.
Another mm-hmm. right, maybe not the
so
full
overall
five.
Overall, 4%, say 3.5% plus some for taxes.
But the key is a big hit in income.
Right, he's gone from 40, he's gone down 20% in what he's taking out to
correct.
Live on.
And he has. There's a good thing to his strategy and a bad thing. The good thing, as Chris said right at the beginning, you'll never run out of money, listener. Because you could theoretically be down to $10 in here. And as long as you only take out 3.5% of $10, $3.50 plus taxes, which won't be any at $3.50. Mm-hmm.
So there's the glaring weakness, that the income coming out of that, if you want to think of it as income, the money coming out of this account to live on is not stable, may not match correctly with your lifestyle and what's really happening with your expenses, but instead is completely subject to the fluctuations in your account value. Now, if those fluctuations tend upwards, maybe you're fine. But if they tend downwards, you're now bucking inflation. Not only is your amount that's available to spend not going up with inflation to afford the things you're buying, it's actually going down. So if you're reliant upon this money to maintain your lifestyle is going down dramatically.
Exactly. So the problem with his strategy is you may not be withdrawing enough money, which means you're then going to have to take out more, and you're getting closer to Bill's strategy. Or on a percentage basis, he's going to be far higher. If he still needed, again, the $40,000 and he's down to $800,000, remember, we did the math in the previous example. Now he's taking out 5.44. So he went to 3.5% all the way up to 5.5% plus taxes. Now he's going to be getting into close to a 6, 6.5%, 7% withdrawal. So here's the thing, listener. If you were going to use your strategy, you'll never run out of money. Bill's strategy, you would. Yours, you won't. As long as you keep cutting how much you take out, you'll never run out as your portfolio drops. And you might be thinking, oh, my portfolio's not going to drop. Go back and listen a couple of weeks ago where Chris and I did a show on the 5 ways your portfolio's going to run out of money. And I did that for a reason, listener. I wanted you to know only one of the ways, Chris, was what?
Spending it.
The fun one, yeah.
Yeah, spending it is the only fun way. Yeah. All the rest of it are bad news.
Exactly.
Right.
Out of the 5 ways your portfolio is going to run out of money in retirement, only one is you spending it. The other 4, the government's going to take it in taxes. Wall Street's going to take it in losses. The economy's going to take it in inflation. And your advisor or investment advisor and financial advisor combined are going to take it in fees. So you're going to have four ways your portfolio is going to drop. Now, you can control the fee one. You don't have to work with an investment advisor who charges a lot, or you can invest passively. But there's still going to be some fees, Chris. It's not totally free to invest. Mm-hmm. So as your portfolio drops, your income's going to drop. If you were only satisfying what Chris and I call desired expenses, then I'm okay with his. Mm-hmm. Because a desired expense, listener, is an expense. If you don't cover, you're going to suffer an emotional loss. Longtime listeners to this podcast know I like to fish. And ever since I went fishing in Alaska, I think it's about 6 years ago now was my first trip out there. I've kind of lost interest in fishing in Colorado. Not the same. Colorado fish would be bait to an Alaskan fish.
True.
So I like to go to Alaska and fish. But if I don't go fishing in Alaska, Chris, I'm going to suffer an emotional hardship. So I could cut it in a down year. So under his scenario, if his 3.5% readjusted for portfolio value is not for what we call a required expense or your minimum dignity floor. We'll get into that in a minute. If it was just for your required expenses, I have no problem with his strategy.
And I would argue if that's truly what this money is being used for, unless he's wanting to leave the bulk of his account as an inheritance for someone, he's under-enjoying his funds.
Go to hell.
He should be spending a lot more than 3.5% unless he's worried about passing that along to someone else. If that's the goal, then you could live on just the, say, just on the upside while protecting most of the capital, called capital preservation.
I do want to make sure people heard the most important thing you said in all that was the first few words. Mm-hmm. If this was only for the desired expenses.
Correct.
Not, Chris isn't saying spend more on requireds. He's saying if it was only for the fun things, and listeners, I do this for a living. You retire once, I help people retire every single day. And when we do that, one of the hardest things I have is to convince people to spend their money. Mm-hmm. When they buy into our process, Chris and I feel very comfortable telling people to spend on their desired expenses far higher. I don't care if you spend 5, 10, 15, 20% in a year. I don't care. I really don't. When you have our process in place. If you don't have a process in place, then I do worry. So if this man or woman is basing this 3.5% adjusted for account value to fully fund just desireds, I fully agree with Chris. Spend more than that. You shouldn't limit yourself at all. You're going to go through three phases of retirement: go-go, slow-go, and no-go. During the go-go years, which are generally when you first retire and you're in your late 50s, early 60s for the majority of people, or mid-60s, and health is still there, spend it. You can't take it with you. So we don't limit our clients on desires. We show them what their budget is, but we don't limit on how much they spend. Because the key for us, and I think where he's missing the boat on his strategy, if this strategy was to fund all his living expenses, requireds and desireds. What's a required? That's your minimum dignity floor, listener. There are certain expenses that no matter how long you live, you've got to cover. Mm-hmm. Fishing in Alaska is not a required expense for me. But paying my property taxes, paying my Medicare premiums, my Medigap premiums, my prescription drug deductibles, paying my property taxes and putting food on the table and maintaining a vehicle. All of these, Chris, I've got to cover. Whether I have $1 million in my retirement account or $100, I've got to cover those expenses. And I believe vehemently, we call that your minimum dignity floor. And we believe vehemently in covering that, listener, not on withdrawals that are not guaranteed, that are not stable, that are not protected, not withdrawals from your retirement assets, but from secure income. Secure income has three parts to it, listener. Number one, it's predetermined and known. The younger you, he doesn't tell us how old he is. Let's just say he's in his early 60s. The younger you in your early 60s can project, Chris, in your 70s, 80s, and 90s, how much he's going to get. There's no ambiguity. He can get very accurate in how much money in the future he's going to get. Number two, secure income is not impacted by the value of your portfolio. It is not impacted by Wall Street. It's not impacted by the Federal Reserve. It doesn't go up if interest rates go up. It doesn't go down if interest rates go down. It doesn't go up if your portfolio rises or down if it falls. Secure income, if it moves at all, it's like a ratchet. It can only move in one direction, and that's up. You know, a ratchet, you ratchet when you can't go back. It's a ratchet. If secure income moves at all, it only moves higher. That's the second part of Chris and I. Chris and I came up with this definition ourselves. And number three, we said secure income is not backed by your assets. It's backed by a deep-pocketed third party. We just described Social Security, pension, and income annuities. Not all these other conflated annuities out there like variable annuities and all that. We're talking income annuities. Simple, safe. We usually talk single premium immediate annuities, deferred income annuities, and the new QLACs, qualified longevity annuity contracts. Those are the three types of income annuities we favor. Those three fit our secure income. Because if your assets run out, and when they run out, listener, you're going to be older. You're going to be in your 80s or 90s, where Chris and I have talked repeatedly on this show that as you age, your ability to understand financial concepts diminishes. We talked about the Harvard study that wanted to know why elderly people, people in their 80s and 90s, were often the victims of financial fraud and abuse. It's because the part of their brain that understands financial concepts ages. The pinnacle age is 53. We talked about that. That part of our brain that understands financial concepts is at its peak at age 53 and then begins to degrade. It's one of the last parts of our brain to develop. And that's why younger folk, kids in their teens and 20s, often make poor money decisions. It's often why most of our clients, Chris, come to us in their 50s and 60s. It's no surprise to me. They're at peak understanding of this. They're starting to realize, hell, I don't know it all. This is difficult. I need help. And they're at that peak age of understanding this. But as they age, when I counsel with my 80 and 90-year-old clients, we have a couple of clients in their 90s. We have a few, almost a dozen in their 80s, and the majority of our clients are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. But when I counsel with those in the 80s and 90s, they don't get it. If I talk about their portfolios too long, I can see it. They're very polite to me, and they nod. It's not resonating. I can see it. And what I share with my clients is as you get into your 80s and 90s, listener, you're not going to understand everything you're trying to do. Picture yourself an 88-year-old trying to figure out what my withdrawal rate this month is going to be. He wants to do this monthly. You're not going to get it. So what Chris and I say is why take the risk? The younger you should put in place an easy to understand and manage plan based on secure income. I get it. It's not exciting. Who wants to run out and buy a damn QLAC? I can't even get Chris to talk about QLACs on the show. We did it for three shows, and those are some of my more popular shows. But I believe in secure income. And Chris may joke with me about QLACs, but you believe in secure income.
I just don't like the name.
QLAC?
QLAC. And we say it so often that it just QLAC. It's one of those things where you hear the same word so much, then it starts to lose meaning. I guess it's not really a word.
But you believe in secure income.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And the concept of a QLAC is fabulous, where you've got this protection from living too long, which is one of the main fears in retirement. You're going to live past you running out of money, and a QLAC generates for you income that will kick in once you're older, if you get to the point where you need that. So it's kind of solving one of the
biggest... And it gives you comfort spending your money
exactly.
earlier.
Exactly. So if you do run out of these other resources, you know this thing is going to kick in later on and not leave you with nothing to live right. throughout the rest of your life.
And it's not just QLACs. There's deferred income
Correct.
Annuity, which is what you would put in a Roth IRA. QLACs are not allowed in Roth IRAs. They're only allowed in regular IRAs. And then if you don't have an IRA at all, you're probably going to buy a SPIA, single premium immediate annuity, if you need the income right away. These are the three main types of income annuities. But that's why Chris and I, though, study Social Security the way we do. We want to optimize, and you listeners should optimize your Social Security, which is the single best form of secure income. I may hate is too harsh of a word. I may be discouraged and disgusted is a much better word with the U.S. government, Congress, the president, not just Trump, all presidents, just they're all the same, Chris, and they do nothing. They run up the national debt, the out of control spending, taxing us to hell, and just setting us up for future failure. We may be disgusted by Congress and our leaders, but I got to give them kudos and credits on Social Security. We like Social Security. It is, I can't say a very well-run plan. It is a bureaucracy. They do make mistakes, a lot of rules in it, but there's nothing. It's because it's devoid of economic reality.
Right. Just because we like it doesn't mean there aren't issues with it. There's issues that need to be fixed with it, but it creates this income source for people that's not susceptible to Wall Street. It isn't affected by current interest rates, which those of you who have looked into annuities realize, or CDs or things like that that used to generate nice income off of retirement savings. You can't get that when your CD is paying 0.1% or something like that. So Social Security, when he says devoid of economic realities, its structure, the formula for benefit, is not based on anything that any of your other financial resources are based upon. It is tied to your work, right? So that's really the tie. So your economic reality of what lifestyle did I generate in the career I chose, that influences then the career and your earnings potential, or your earnings, what they really were during your career, plays a part in the calculation. It has nothing to do with Wall Street.
Absolutely.
Has nothing to do with how much you saved. Has nothing to do with interest rates at the time or where they're going to go when you're 80, any of that kind of stuff. So it effectively protects you from all that, and it adjusts with inflation.
So what we think you need to do, and you didn't give us enough info here, listener, but if you put your minimum dignity floor in place, if you figure out what that is that you're going to need for the rest of your life to maintain a dignified lifestyle, that's why I call it the minimum dignity floor. Protect it with secure income. Optimize your Social Security. And if you have a wife, optimize his or hers as well. If you have a pension, Chris and I very rarely recommend taking a lump sum pension, but analyze the pension, and most likely you're going to take it as an income stream. That's what you have it for. Top it off with any income annuity that you may need. Have that minimum dignity floor in place. Then your desired fun expenses, those can be covered with withdrawals. And you don't really need to then limit yourself to Bill Benjamin's 4 or 4.3 or your own self-imposed 3.5. Once that minimum dignity floor is in place, and one other caveat, when we work with a client, not only do we put the minimum dignity floor, Chris, in place, we make sure and we run in our analysis what would happen if you or your spouse dies early in retirement. That is key. So many people just think the two of them are going to live into their 90s and then die peacefully in their sleep, and they set themselves up for a problem as a widower. So we will do an analysis as well to look at what would happen if one of you died early in retirement. We just chose 5 years randomly. What would happen if the husband, what would happen if the wife passed away early in retirement? Because there's a loss in Social Security income. There could be a loss in pension income. There could be there's going to be the widower tax penalty. The widower or the widow is going to be pushed into a higher bracket, so more taxes is coming out. What is this going to do? Once we protect for that, Chris, we then look at the opposite. What happens if you live too long and you start suffering a long-term care need? Married couples need to understand they are on the hook for each other. Divorce doesn't get you out of this. Some people say, well, I'll just divorce if my spouse needs it, and then the government will take care of them. No, you're still on the hook, believe it or not. So you have to start to look at these things, Chris, and see what would happen if one of us lived too long. Put a long-term care plan in place. So you got to put a widower plan in place, a long-term care in place, and your income plan in place. Once all three of those are in place, or you acknowledge that two of them, not the income one, but the longevity and the widower plan is, we're going to ignore it. If some people do that, they say, you know what, we're not going to worry about that, Jim. We're not going to die too soon. We're not going to live too long. It's going to be the perfect porridge. I've had people say that. But once you either acknowledge you're going to ignore the widower's penalty and the longevity, or you're going to address it and put a plan in place for those. Whatever you do, once that is set, then just go spend the damn money that's left over. That's my take on it. I lost my best friend last year. You know that. He was only 47 years old, and he died early last year. He was told he had 6 months to live. He lived five. And I don't talk about Rob much. But what I want people to understand from that, we're all going to be in Rob's shoes someday. And maybe not the way it was diagnosed to him, but the ultimate fate is going to happen. And as you go through retirement, you're one diagnosis away from going from the go-go years to the no-go or slow-go. So why limit yourself? You think I'm only going to fish if the market is up? Bull. I'm going to fish every single day if I can, because I don't know how long I'm going to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. And I may not pass as Rob did. I'm hoping I can live a long time. But I may develop a condition that I won't be able to fish anymore. So we don't believe on your pure desired expenses to limit yourself to this needless self-imposed, quote-unquote, safe withdrawal rate. Bill Benjamin and safe withdrawal rates and Monte Carlo probability statistics are all ways for investment advisors to keep charging you 1.25% of your assets. That's all it is. It's a marketing ploy. It's designed to keep you invested and keep you hiring them to figure out all these ways that you need to invest your money and pay them a fee and hopefully not run out. Chris and I, we don't believe in that. We believe in pensions, not lump sum payouts. We believe in Social Security, not claim as early as you can and invest that money because I'm going to earn you more. And we believe in a simple, straightforward income annuity, not these variable BS annuities that are out there with high fees and low payouts. We just believe in keeping it simple, protecting that minimum dignity floor, protecting if you die too early, protecting if you live too long. Those two are optional. You choose if you want them. And then whatever money is left, folks, spend it. Because I'm telling you, I'm going to spend mine as fast as I can. I'm going to enjoy that. I'm going to go hunting and fishing and hiking while my health allows. And then as I slow down, maybe I'll do more benign hobbies, traveling or pickleball or something like that. But you like that pickleball. My mom and sister are into it now. They moved to Florida, and now they're into pickleball. I'm like, nice. Oh, my God. So anyways, I know I kind of went overboard on this answer, but I was just trying to give him food for thought. I can't tell him if it's good or bad, his approach, but I am telling all our listeners, protect your minimum dignity floor. Figure out what that floor is. Protect it. Protect dying too soon. Protect living too long. Those last two are optional. But once you have that retirement plan in place, take the rest of your money, go have fun. And you don't have to limit yourself to a 2, 3, 4% withdrawal rate. I don't care how fast you spend it. That's your lifetime budget. I just don't know how long you're going to be here. Enjoy it while you can. Okay.
Perfect. Thanks for that. So if you have any questions on that, if you want to know a little bit more about our process, please contact us. Our best contact method is jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. On there, you can find a contact us button, and you can reach out to us either via email or a message, a form submission, if you will, or call us the old-fashioned way, 970-530-0556.
And we should mention to our iTunians, because this is now pure iTunian show, we work with people throughout the nation. Mm-hmm. We're based in Colorado. We're a small local company with a national reach. We work, thanks to the internet, we work with people all over the country.
So thanks, everyone. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new podcast.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Today, to cut to the chase, it's going to be an interesting topic. Again, you can get this in the newsletter. This will be part of Justin's article that comes out monthly in our newsletter. If you don't have our newsletter and you'd like to get it, go to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Jimhelps.com. Right in, it's either the upper left or the upper right-hand side of the webpage, there's a sign up for our newsletter button. Just click that and put in your email. We don't mark it. We don't sell your email. It's perfectly safe. We don't do anything with it but send you a monthly newsletter. And there's an opt-out button right at the bottom of the email, so it's very easy to stop receiving it if you no longer want to get it. But it's chock full of information we think you might find valuable. So, that said, Justin, why don't you introduce a little bit about your topic and how you want to approach teaching our listeners today. And we're mainly going to talk about joint property ownership, joint tenancy with rights of survivorship, and tenants in common. Mm-hmm. Those are the two main ways of property ownership. We're not going to talk about some of the other more limited ways, or not limited, but less common ways of owning property. We do acknowledge there are other ways of owning property, but these are the two big ways of owning it, and we're going to talk a little bit about the differences. When we get Pete on the show next, Chris, we're going to have him opine a little bit on a lot of the estate issues and tax issues with owning the property, but today we're going to give people a general overview of the two different ways.
Yeah, so the general overview is, a lot of people have ownership of property in one or the other of these types. So it's joint with rights of survivorship or joint tenants in common, often known by their acronyms, JTWROS or TIC, T-I-C for tenants in common. So what I wanted to get into this month on the newsletter is just three basic things that revolve around that, and it's the owners or their rights when it comes to each piece of property and how it's titled. What happens when one of the owners die, and also what happens regarding your basis or the basis that your heirs will have after you pass away. So kind of three topics there, the ownership, and the what happens when you die, and the basis. So you want me to just dig into that, or do you want to opine?
I got nothing to say.
He's got nothing to say. He's doing other business.
All right, well, so I broke it down into those three topics, and when it comes to joint with rights of survivorship, what it does is it actually gives each owner equal rights to the entire account or asset or piece of property. So a lot of people see that as, oh, it's split 50-50, but in reality, you both own it at 100%.
Right.
Okay? So if the asset's sold, it typically and most always needs consent from both parties to sell it. So I think we could probably think of many different upsides and downsides to that, but a lot of downsides. You can't just simply cash out a portion of it on your own and have a check made out to you, right? You got to get the other joint owner on board and sell it together, right?
Mm-hmm.
So lots of times this is how spouses title things because they feel like they're in it for the long run. They'll make it through more difficult times in life. And, if they need to cash out, it'll be easy to have that talk with each other. But it's definitely a form of ownership that people use in other formats, whether just partners in a business. But you can see where if, let's just say Jim and I owned this building that we're sitting in together, and we had a falling out at some point in time, and I wanted to sell half my ownership, I couldn't without him signing off on it. So we could see the
and I wouldn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No.
I'd stick it to him.
Yeah. I would just rent my
Seems
half
fair.
Out to someone crazy.
That's why I own this property alone.
A cat collector.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The many things I went through my head, I don't think was radio appropriate. But, so on the other hand, TIC, or tenants in common, actually assigns an interest percentage to each owner, right? So rather than both of them owning 100% of it, you own a proportional part, or a part of it. So, you know, Jim might own 30% of something, I might own 70% of something, and that is how it's split up. So in that case, I could sell my portion at any point in time, right? And Jim could sell his portion at any point in time, and we don't need each other's consent in any way, shape, or form. So it's a consentless relationship, right? But in other ways, you can also add to things. So, you know, if it's, let's just say it's an account of some sort, I could add more to this account and my proportional ownership would increase, or I could sell parts of it and it would decrease at that point in time, right? So ownership rights vary completely, right, on these two. Mm-hmm. Makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. All right. So what happens to each one of these accounts when you die? Now, this is where things become very, very clear. So the distinction is just apparent, and we've seen it many times, I think. I have, so at least in my lifetime. So when a joint with rights of survivorship, when someone dies, okay, it's actually passed directly to that other joint owner. It doesn't go through your will, or it doesn't go through state intestacy laws. It passes right through, right? So there's a direct beneficiary.
So because both people own 100%, if one drops off due to, in this particular case, death, that's certainly one way to drop off, there's still somebody remaining that owns 100% of the property.
Yep.
Right? So it's more like drop off than transfer. There's really nothing to transfer. They already own all of it.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of automatic. There's nothing extra you do. There is some paperwork that you file in order to, if you want to officially have the other person's name mm-hmm. come off of there. Because normally if you go to sell an asset, if it's seen that there's both names on there, both people, if it's joint tenancy with right of survivorship, you've got to have both people there to sign off on the sale.
Mm-hmm.
So you're clearly, if somebody dies, going to want to officially remove that person and have it left just in the one person's name. But that's really all the paperwork, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
There's nothing else that
you have to do. Pretty straightforward on that mm-hmm. one. However, there's a little oddity that happens with that. So for the tax geeks out there or people that are interested in taxes, it's a little different depending on who that joint owner is and how that property is taxed from an estate side, right? So if you're subject to estate tax or you're filing an estate return to, show that it was part of the estate and create step-ups and basis later on, if the joint owner is your spouse, no matter what, no matter how much each of you contributed to it, 50% of it passes through the estate. Just that's how it works, okay? However, if it is not your spouse, then it depends on how much you contributed, what your proportional ownership was, and that gets passed through the estate. So it gets a little confusing on the estate side. But
right. So and this is where the difference, you might be saying, well, wait a minute, I thought you said everybody's 100% or both parties are 100%.
Yeah.
The ownership claim is one thing. The estate law issue is a separate question.
Completely.
There's essentially two sets of rules here that apply to the same type of account ownership.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And let's move over to tenants in common. It's completely different. So if the assets are disposed, they're always disposed via your will or through intestate laws, right? So you don't skip probate on this one. It just has to go through probate, right? Mm-hmm. So if you say Chris and I own something together and Chris passes away, that doesn't come to me as the joint owner, the other joint owner. It goes to his estate and then is divvied out from that point in time. If I happen to be in his estate and he assigns it to me, then maybe it'll come back to me at that point in time, but generally that's not how it works.
But I got to assign that to somebody else. So mm-hmm. if I wanted my sister to own it or something like that,
mm-hmm.
if it was joint tenant with right of survivorship, which is the more common situation, you'd have the remaining person that's on there automatically get total ownership of it. Whereas tenants in common, the two pieces kind of stay separate, and mm-hmm. you can direct those two pieces separately So, I mean, I can already see where, depending on what you're wanting to do with your assets over your life, particularly when you pass away, especially if you have a blended family with, you know, stepkids and an ex-wife and all, you know, everything goes in a blended family situation, you might actually not want to automatically have a new piece of property or something you own together with your second spouse to go to that spouse. Maybe you want your piece to go to your biological children or something like that. You could do that with tenants in common, mm-hmm. but you couldn't do that with joint tenants with right of survivorship.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And what I've seen a lot of times is people don't realize the difference, and they go through this extra step of probate and say it's a husband and wife that are tenants in common, and they just want it to go right to their spouse. Mm-hmm. And then one dies and it has to go through probate to come back to that person rather than just not transferring ownership, just moving mm-hmm. ownership 100% to the other spouse. So right. it depends on what your ultimate goals are, I guess, on that one. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the decedent's share is just passed through the estate at that point in time with tenants in common. It goes right through the estate. So their proportional share of that account or property goes through it. So makes sense, right?
So
all
far,
on board?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. Now, the last thing that I wanted to talk about was basis. I can't say that I've heard you guys talk about basis extensively on the show.
Talk about
you
it.
You mustn't listen to the show very often. It comes up. It
comes up occasionally.
It yeah.
comes up occasionally.
So our listeners have
so
a good idea.
We're talking about the tax basis, right? Yeah. Basis for tax mm-hmm. purposes in this context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's do a little review of what basis is. You know, if I just simply bought a rental property of some sort for $100,000, and then later on sold it for $50,000. In the most basic example, I would have a $100,000 basis, and then when I sold it, I would have a $50,000 gain. I obviously wouldn't be taxed for that additional $100,000 that I had already put in, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's this thing called step-up in basis, which I know you guys have talked about before. So when I pass away, let's just say on the same day, rather than selling it, I died, and my heirs receive that, they should get a step up in basis. So that extra $50,000 is now stepped up. So they have a basis of $150,000. They could turn around and sell it and not pay any taxes, right? So right. that's the idea of basis and step up. Now, this applies, I mean, basis is ridiculously complicated. If you ever sit down and try and figure it out, it's always this moving number. But another thing that makes it more difficult is titling. Okay. So, step up in basis is really, I feel, driven by what passes through the estate. Okay, mm-hmm. So it's entirely that figure. So the rules for each one of these are you can already think, maybe imagine, three different scenarios: two for the joint with rights of survivorship, which we talked about, one for spouse and one for non-spouse, and another scenario for the tenants in common. It's whatever passes through the estate gets that step up in basis, right? So if you are a married couple and your spouses and one owner passes away, 50% of that property is going to pass through that owner's estate, mm-hmm. and that spouse will get a 50% step up in basis, right? But if it's joint with rights of survivorship and your non-spouses, then it just depends on the proportional share that passed through the estate and then got that step up. So if one owner owned 10% and they passed away, then there would only be a 10% step up, right?
Hmm.
And that's very similar.
You're right that some of this stuff becomes kind of confusing.
Yeah.
Because it's going to depend a little bit on what titling method you used, tenants in common or joint tenancy with right of survivorship, and then if you're married or not, and what's going through the estate or not, all of those issues apply. So we'll expand it. We'll clean that up a little bit when we come back.
And we're
going
to talk also, what's the difference with title ownership and a beneficiary designation? So we'll tie that
that's
in.
A good point.
Yes.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us here on the Retirement and IRA Show. This is the first segment here on the September 16th show. When we come back from this short break, we are going to hear one of the top songs from 1935 in honor of the start of Social Security, which started August of 1935, very long time ago. So we're going to hear a popular song from then just to tie this into the show. We'll be back right after this short break.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show for September 16th, 2017, Part 2.
Life begins when somebody's eyes look into your own. Life begins when you get your gal all alone. From morning until twilight, I don't know I'm alive. But I know love begins at 8:45.
Hey, welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is about a quarter to nine, which is where that reference to 8:45 comes in, of course. About a quarter to nine, which is sung by Al Jolson, as you could probably recognize if you've heard him sing before. This is from the 1935 Warner Brothers film Go Into Your Dance, which starred Al Jolson and Ruby Keeler, who were married at the time. Al Jolson was the first to perform this song, but it became a popular favorite in 1935 that spawned multiple versions. The version by Johnny Green and his orchestra charted as high as number 5, but other bands such as Victor Young and Ozzie Nelson hit the top 10 as well. So that actually was very common back then, if you didn't know Junior Justin, that one person would record it, and then like they didn't wait for several years and then cover the song.
Right.
They would just all cover the song in the same year, so there'd be like 18 different versions of the same song going on from all these different people.
Who can do it best type of thing?
I think it was kind of competitive, which is strange because, you know, you think that the one person who wrote the song might want to pick just one person to sing it, but no, that's not how it worked, apparently.
Well, the songwriters were probably making a good buck, you know?
Let's hope.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
Yeah.
So we left off the last segment talking about the differences, the commonalities and differences between account or property titling tenants in common versus joint tenants with right of survivorship. And Justin did a really good job, I think. Right, Jim? Yeah, I thought. So
he was paying attention, you know, the whole time.
I just thought I'd do what he does that to me, too. I'm busy working on something. And then, right, Chris?
Yeah.
Justin did a great job of kind of describing the differences. What we ended up with was probably the most complex issue with this titling question, and that is how basis is handled, how the cost basis for purposes of tax calculations are handled. As the ownership changes, usually through the death of one of the parties or that sort of thing. So we all know about the step up in basis, where if you are if you've left assets to someone else, say stocks, bonds, real estate property, etc., when you leave those assets to someone when you pass away, they receive a step up in basis. So it doesn't matter what the original person, maybe you, if you're the person we're talking about here, paid for the assets to begin with. If you had sold them right prior to death, you had to worry about your original basis. The difference between the basis and what you sold it for, you're going to be taxed on that, depending on exactly what you're selling and your tax brackets. But if you pass away, there's actually a very beneficial side effect to that, if you will, that those assets all receive a step up in basis so that the person inheriting those assets gets to start fresh with the new market value the day of death, and then they only owe taxes on any amount they sell above that. But they could sell it the day they inherited it. If it's still valued the same as the day you died, there'd be no tax implications when that person sold it. But we're talking about here when there's split ownership, when you have more than one person on the title of property, what exactly happens. And so I kind of wanted to give that lead and make sure everybody's up to speed with the concept of basis.
Excellent summary.
But maybe you can compare and contrast again, because I think you even lost me a little bit, because this is always keeping track of these details on this is always kind of confusing. But joint tenants with right of survivorship, when one, let's say there's two cases, married couple,
right,
and then there's no issue, original basis sticks, correct? Joint tenants with right of survivorship.
You've got two spouses.
One spouse passes away. Yes. The remaining spouse gets the property.
Right.
But the basis hasn't changed. There's no step up.
No. Correct? No. 50% passes through the estate.
Oh. That's true.
Yeah. 50% will pass through the estate.
I wasn't paying attention. What are we talking about?
Joint tenants with right of survivorship with spouses. When one spouse dies, that half gets a step up.
Oh, half gets a step up. Oh. And in that particular case, if they're married, it not matter? It doesn't matter who contributed what. It's right. If you're not married.
Right.
Exactly. So we're handling spouses. But if they're not married, then it's a slightly different question. Mm-hmm. But the half that the half of the property gets a step up? Even
now, in a community property state, the entire property gets a step up twice.
That's what I was remembering, is the community property states, of which Colorado is not one, so this isn't as big an issue here, since this is
if you're in
Colorado
Arizona
edition,
California, I believe, is Texas a community property state? Is this little thing here called
I always say
Google.
Arizona and California, but the I didn't realize you got half and then full step up. I thought it was no step up and then full step. So you get half a step up in Colorado.
Exactly.
I don't remember everything in the world.
Yeah, so that's why it's important to file those estate tax returns, even if maybe you don't owe estate tax, right?
The community property states, just so we all know, and I'm going to do this just because I know the states. I'm that good. Google just highlights the states and tell you what they are.
Oh, so you're just going to go by sight as to
my
the
geography,
shape of the state?
My knowledge of geography. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Except this one state out there, I'm pretty sure that's Minnesota. No, that's not Minnesota.
Yeah, let's see how you do.
No, oh, shoot, what the hell is that? That's Wisconsin.
We've got a map of the states literally right behind him. But
okay, we have Washington,
Idaho,
Nevada, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana. And all those states touch.
Yeah, they all follow the border there. That's
and
a good way to remember
then
it.
Then they throw Wisconsin in way up there for the hell of it.
Yeah. I did not know New Mexico. I had heard the rest, but I didn't know New Mexico.
So
and
if
they're a neighbor, I feel bad.
Oh.
Well, this part of the podcast will be on our iTunes. So any iTunian, if you again are in Washington, Idaho, Nevada, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, and just shoot straight up north from Louisiana, a couple of states, you hit the fine state of Wisconsin. All those states are community property states. And Alaska should be on here as well, but I don't see it. Alaska is weird. You can be or not. Alaska
cheese.
Is an opt-in community property state that gives both parties the option to choose community property.
Isn't there one more opt-in one out there, too?
I only heard Alaska.
I think there's another opt-in one.
A very fine state,
Puerto
by
Rico,
the way.
Maybe.
I don't know.
If I could live anywhere, it would be Alaska, I think.
All right.
Have you been there in the winter?
No, it's cold and dark.
Yeah, that's why I'm... Mm, yeah.
For really long
and time. And a lot of the coastal area that doesn't get super cold because it's close to the ocean rains all the time.
So in other words, it's a depressing place to live?
Yeah, it could be. I'm just saying you might want to mix it up. You might want to go other than the prime time of the 2 weeks in the summertime that you've enjoyed it.
It sounds like Western New York where I grew up.
Because the other 51 weeks of the year
too good?
Aren't so special.
I know the 2 weeks that I go. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but anyways, community property stakes, folks, will get a total step up. Justin and Chris are debating the 50% step up. But in a community property state, at the death of the first spouse, so let's say you and your spouse purchased a home for $200,000 and one spouse passes away and the house is worth now $500,000. At the death of the first spouse, that $300,000 of capital gains is wiped out. steps up. The new basis is now $500,000. And then that second spouse passes away 10 years later when the property is now worth $1 million. Again, all these numbers are being made up. But that $1 million from $500,000 to $1 million, that half a million also steps up. So you get a double step up in basis.
For community property states.
Community property states,
yeah, very different. Very different. So, with spouses, it definitely makes a difference mm-hmm. with rights of survivorship. It's a big, big player there. Now, if it's you're just not spouses, it plays out fairly normally, and it's how much, you know, basically your ownership percentage, really, what you contributed on a percentage mm-hmm. basis. So, if someone only contributed 10%, there would only be a 10% step up in basis.
Right.
And if you can't prove basis, and this is where we need Pete, but I believe Pete was saying if you can't prove basis in that situation, then no step up happens at the death of the first. If you can't prove that that person contributed anything.
Or whatever. Yeah.
So yeah. It's important to keep copious records when doing this. But before we run out of time, let's talk a little bit about, this is property titlement and ownership. How does this differ from a beneficiary designation? That confuses people sometimes. This property ownership is not a beneficiary designation. Someone else can inherit the property at the property owner's death. What's a beneficiary designation, and how would that work? Do you want to tackle that? Do you want me to?
Well, I can
okay, go ahead.
Say how it's different. Right?
Fire away.
With a beneficiary form, the original property, whatever it might be, usually an account of some kind, isn't co-owned by anyone else. It's the owner's property. The ownership doesn't transfer until the death of the owner of the property, and then it passes through right of law to the beneficiary designated on the beneficiary designation form. So there isn't these other ones we were talking about, there had to be some type of commingled ownership or multiple owners involved in the accounts that you were talking about, or at least the style of ownership you were talking about. There's others, actually, that we're only talking kind of about three major ones that people run into, but there's other variations on this. But with the beneficiary designation form, all ownership is held by, could be one or possibly more than one party, but then the beneficiary can be a completely different person, and that person then would inherit those things not through probate and will process, but rather just the law allows titling of that property to be changed in some way, or the benefits of that property to be assigned to a beneficiary named on the beneficiary form.
I like that.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. Yeah.
Reason why so I kind of said at that last part is, you know, a lot of people think that, say, an IRA has a beneficiary designation form, so you specify it. It actually does not become owned by the other person. It's still the original person's IRA legally.
Right.
It's just the benefits from that account are assigned to someone
Beneficiaries
else.
Beneficiaries have no legal right to the account as an owner or anything. They have no say in how the account is managed or anything. Now, we're talking on a asset-based account. Beneficiary of a trust is a little different. The trustee of the trust needs to manage the account for the benefit of the beneficiary. So the beneficiary of a trust has a little more say in how the assets are managed, what's to be done with it. So it's a different type of beneficiary when you're on a trust. But if you're a beneficiary of a retirement account, or let's say, Justin, it's property, and you're on a TOD or a POD style account, and you're named as beneficiary. Why don't you explain a little bit about what that is? Because those beneficiaries, Chris, also have no say in how the asset is managed, just because you're named as a payable on death or transfer on death.
Well, so I think you just summed up what the TOD and the POD are, but generally those are account titling, or you're designating who would receive that account in the case of an individual person passing. So a TOD is usually designated, I believe, for brokerage accounts and things like that. It's a transfer on death. It transfers over, where the POD
is a payable on death, usually reserved. Banks typically do it, and you know, if someone passes away, then it's payable on death to that person without going through probate.
And once that happens, say a brokerage account was transferred, say a TOD transferred on death to a beneficiary, at that point, just to clarify what Jim was saying, they then have a say in how that account is managed.
Right.
But what Jim's saying is just because your name is a beneficiary, while the owner is alive, you have no say in how those assets are managed. So you might be thinking, you know, I'm ultimately going to get this as the beneficiary of this account. I'd like it to grow, or I'd like it to do this or that. You have absolutely no say in that account whatsoever until it actually transfers to you, and then the reins get handed to you. And,
correct.
And you might have some,
unlike
some
the beneficiary of a trust,
correct,
that would have some say. So a trust beneficiary is a little bit different, but I guess the big point I wanted listeners to understand is if you're a beneficiary of account, except for a trust, but if you're a beneficiary of a payable on death account, a transfer on death account, or if you are a beneficiary, trying to think of what other type of account
you can actually do them on joint with rights survivorship accounts.
You could, and yep. You can also do a beneficiary deed now in the state of Colorado. Mm-hmm. This we will be talking about when we bring Pete on the show. That's why we wanted to get today's topic out of the way, because a beneficiary deed is a way to pass a house to someone
without going through the traditional probate process.
And you can do it with vehicles now too.
Yep.
So it's other ways of naming someone to inherit your accounts. But while you are alive, those people have no rights to the property. They can't. You don't need their permission to sell the property. So if you were going to leave your house or your vehicle via one of these Colorado rules that they have, these beneficiary deed type documents, that person has no rights to stop a sale, to sell it themselves. They have no rights to say how the property should be managed or taken care of. They're just going to step in at your death. That's when their ownership takes over. But that's a little different than the property ownership structure when you name someone on it, because now that person is totally involved in that property. They technically own it. Or own some of it. And as owners, they have different rights and different says than if they were beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the other benefits to, or I guess what they don't have, these beneficiaries, they don't even have the right to know that that account or property exists. They don't.
For their benefit.
For their benefit.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah, you don't have to tell anyone when you name them as a transfer on death account or a payable on death account. If you have a bank account, you have a payable on death. If you have a brokerage style account, you have a transfer on death. And you don't have to tell the people, even on a regular IRA beneficiary form, Chris.
Right.
You don't need to tell the person. You don't need the person's permission or signature or anything to name them as a beneficiary. Now, on a trust, that would be a little different. You still technically don't need any of their information, but again, beneficiaries of a trust, when they do inherit the property or the property is transferred to them, doesn't necessarily have to transfer at death, and that trust now is being managed for their benefit, they do have far more say. They can have some say to the trustee on how the property is managed, if it should be managed for growth like Chris was just talking about, or if it should be managed for income, if it should be invested, if it should be put in principal safety items. The beneficiary of a trust has more power. And that kind of gets close to some of the power that an owner would have. Even though the beneficiary of the trust does not own the property, the trust does, the beneficiary of the trust has a lot of say in what the trust does with the property. But ultimately, it's the trustee who will decide. So the beneficiary may want one thing, and the trustee decides it's in the best interest of all beneficiaries, or even that beneficiary, not to do what the beneficiary wants, but to do something else.
So you got to go through a middleman there.
Yeah, or you end up in court.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit different with trusts, but we just wanted people to understand the differences between being a beneficiary of an account and being an owner. And then the two main style of property ownership, joint with rights of survivorship, and tenants in common. You see tenants in common a lot with real estate, especially when you have a building with multiple offices in it. I know my CPA belongs to one of these Tenants in Common offices off of Drake Road in Fort Collins. So she owns some of that building, a percentage equal to the amount of space that her office takes up. So she owns some and the others own some. And now there's rules. It's kind of like a HOA involved in the matter. But she gets to enjoy the appreciation of the property or the fall of the property as it did in 08. But when she goes to move, she sells her ownership. So they all own kind of like their own office. Little different approach, but you often see tenants in common in real estate. Now, one thing, and we've talked about this before, Chris, and Justin, you can opine, and if when Pete's here, he'll talk more about this. You may have a building that's worth, say, $600,000, and Chris, you own half, and I own half as tenants in common, which means you can do what you want with your half, I can do what I want in my half. But if I go to sell my half, I'm probably not going to get $300,000 for it, because who's going to really want to own half a building where the other half is owned by someone else that they may not like or runs a business that they don't want much to do with? So you have kind of that valuation discount built in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that definitely could be an issue with tenants in common.
Yeah.
What any other tidbits from the newsletter that you'd like to share with us, Justin?
No, that's it. I just, you were really going off on real estate there, and what I've seen, and I'd have to brush up on this, but and Pete might know this right off the top of his head. I know in the past, and I'm not sure if Colorado still does that, but if you entered into a real estate joint ownership of some sort, they used to default just to one of them, and I believe it was. I believe it was with rights of survivorship on it, but I'd have to double check that. So you may not even know it that you've entered into an agreement with someone and it's titled in a certain way, especially under a real estate case. And you may have troubles when it comes to selling, or you may not know how to handle things when one person dies. So I would definitely go on to maybe your county assessor's website and find the documents, or just maybe find your actual own documents that say it and find out how is it owned. And maybe for all of your accounts, how is it owned? What's the titling on it? Who are the beneficiaries? It's a really important thing.
Yeah. And if you're going to enter into any type of real estate transaction with someone, let's just say you're a hunter and you and your buddies want to buy one of those 35-acre lots that border National Forest, because you think, oh, we're going to camp on that 35 acres and then we're going to head into the National Forest and hunt. How do you own that? How do you structure it? Well, if you guys all own it as joint with rights of survivorship, there's going to be pros and cons to that as one person wants out. Well, when that other person wants out, generally the other joint owners would be the ones to buy it from them. And what if they don't want to buy it? What, they might be able to bring in a third person and sell them that, but it starts to get a little difficult because all, let's just say there's three or four owners, all the owners have to agree to it. So you might want to own it as tenants in common. Let's say four hunters want to do it, so each hunter owns 25% of that property. And if one hunter wants out, he or she can sell their 25% to another hunter. Now, they probably won't get a full one quarter for the value because that other person buying is going to say, wow, I get to share this with three other people. So I'm not going to give you one quarter the value. I'm going to give you a little less. But you're not going to need the permission of the other three people if you want out, if the friendship is breaking up. So you got to really think sometimes how you guys, I'm not just talking to hunters out here, but how anyone structures property and titles it. And that's where talking to a good, competent attorney like Pete. For those who don't know, Pete is Pete Scott. He used to be on the show on a regular basis, but he went and turned 67 and decided to retire. And he's only on the show on certain days. But he is going to be coming back on. And we'll bring him involved. We'll make him involved. We'll bring him up to date on this topic and let him opine on a lot of what we said.
Perfect. So that music means we're here at the end of another Retirement and IRA Show, Colorado edition, here on KFKA.
If you want to reach us, tell them how they can.
Well, they can.
Do you want to tell them?
Sure. How about go to jimhelps.com? That's Jim, HELPS.com. On there, there's a contact us button, and you can reach out via a variety of ways there. You can phone us. You can send us a message. We're more than happy to answer emails. So if you have any questions, please let us know that way. Have anything else to say before we bail out in the last 6 seconds?
Negative. Except have a great weekend, yeah, folks. And we'll see you again next week on the Retirement and IRA Show, Colorado Edition.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.